The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from National Geographic. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles that we'll be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. Conflicts and wars have occurred in many areas of the world in recent years and continue even today as we speak. One country that has endured multiple prolonged wars is Afghanistan. Its seemingly endless conflicts have generated numerous headlines over the years. Today on Armchair Traveler, writer Jason Motlak takes us on a 2,000-mile journey on Afghanistan's Lost Road. A caption for a map that appeared with Motlak's article reads, "For 2 weeks, our team drove 2,000 miles along Afghanistan's Ring Road and its spurs to document life since the 2021 Taliban takeover. Started in the 1950s, the highway was destroyed by successive wars, rebuilt in the 2000s, and devastated again by forces fighting U.S. occupation." The article appeared in the October 2022 issue of the National Geographic, and it's accompanied by photographer Blaise Gardet Motlak photographs, and it finds that what's left of the nation's major highway reveals a battered nation moving in reverse. And let me give you a caption from the cover story. These men dressed in turbans and the current style of wear for men. "Turbaned men shade from midday sun in Sangasar, Kandahar province, where Mullah Muhammad Omar founded the Taliban in the 1990s. Loyalists from around the country come to pray in the mosque that Mullah Ha'utullah, second from the right in the picture, now leads." He bears a beard, a man probably in his 50s, and a nice watch, and the turban, and typical men's dress for that area. So there you go. That gives you an idea of kind of the surroundings that we'll be going through as we take this journey. Let us begin. "We're free at last from the crush of Kabul morning traffic. And the map on my smartphone estimates it'll take 9 hours to drive 300 miles to Kandahar on National Highway 1, the most expensive and important road in Afghanistan. The United States poured hundreds of millions of dollars into this stretch of asphalt, one leg of the 1,400-mile road that circles the country, to speed travel and boost commerce between the nation's capital and its second-largest city. But it would be foolish to make dinner plans in Kandahar. The highway was first built in the 1950s and 60s by the Soviet Union and the United States, Cold War rivals jockeying for influence over Kabul. It was ruined by decades of war and neglect, and only about 30 miles of paved road remained in 2001. When the Kabul to Kandahar stretch was repaired and reopened in 2003, U.S. envoy Salve Khalizad proclaimed, 'We are standing literally on the road to Afghanistan's future. It is a future of prosperity. It is a future of peace.' 19 years later, the battered roadway is a bone-rattling testament of the toll of rampant violence and graft that followed instead. Less than an hour south of Kabul in Wardak province, the pavement starts to break apart, pockmarked by craters from Taliban explosives and weakened by ripples in cheap asphalt, forcing me to peel off the road or slam on the brakes repeatedly to avoid accidents. I seldom shift above third gear. Burqa-clad widows begging for handouts and boys with shovels are accused to slow down for more bomb damage. In the absence of repair crews, children such as Asnullah, 15, and his brother Raifullah, 10, pack chasms with dirt from dawn until dark for tips of $2 on a good day. Our father is sick and my older brother is an addict, Asnullah sighs. What else can we do? The drive is less stressful than my last trip through the stronghold of the Taliban, the hardline Sunni Muslim militia that first seized power in 1996 and was ousted by the U.S. in 2001 for sheltering Osama bin Laden after the 9/11 attacks. In August 2020, I was on this road as Taliban militants were hammering Afghan army convoys. Firefights erupted out of nowhere, and a trickle of civilians traveled at their peril as outgunned government troops hunkered down in bullet-strafed outposts. The police outpost where I'd spent the night is now a heap of rubble. Dozens more are abandoned. The steel wire casings from dirt-filled defensive barriers scavenged for scrap. Columns of hard-packed earth are worn down by rains, dotting the hills like a constellation of ancient ruins. Hulks of tanks destroyed during the 1979-89 Soviet occupation sit within eyeshot of mangled American Humvees of more recent vintage, a jarring mashup of nation-building ventures gone wrong. It's been a year since the Taliban seized power again as the U.S. withdrew its forces after 20 years. Photographer Balis Gardi and I have rented a Toyota Land Cruiser to traverse National Highway 1, better known as the Ring Road, which connects four major cities in the east, south, west, and north. In our two decades of reporting in Afghanistan, it was too perilous before to make the full journey. But a lull in violence presents a rare opportunity to explore a country emerging from U.S. occupation. Over 2 weeks, 18 provinces and 2,084 miles, including off-road forays on rocky terrain that dent our truck, we meet hardened fighters, itinerant farmers, women enduring the draconian restrictions not seen since 2001, and children forced to work to support their families. A unifying thread is relief that a long war that killed more than 150,000 Afghans is over and a semblance of order restored. But there is also gathering despair that the new Taliban regime is no milder than its original incarnation. Despite promising amnesty for former enemies and respect for rights of minorities and women, the Taliban have carried out summary executions of government forces who surrendered, have failed to stop sectarian attacks, and have aggressively erased efforts at women's inclusion, from barring them from certain government jobs and forcing women newscasters to cover their faces to banning secondary education for girls. Since the Taliban takeover, the heavily aid-dependent economy has dried up, leaving 95% of the population hungry, according to the World Food Program. In dusty urban centers and crumbling villages, we find new traces of the two-decade U.S.-led modernization project. With each mile we drive, ominous signs of Afghanistan's dark and insular past emerge, underscoring a sense of a country moving in reverse. We turn off the highway in Sheikh Abad onto a gravel road to visit Roshanak Wardak, a physician and outspoken former member of parliament. Wardak, in her hair covered by a black scarf, is virtually at a loss for words when we meet. It's the first day of school across the country, and the Taliban have just announced that girls above sixth grade will be barred from attending. "I am in shock," says a stone-faced Wardak. She says a cell phone video of a teenager pleading for entry into class, it means destruction of her future. A human being without education will be nothing, she adds. Wardak opened a women's clinic in 1996, shortly before the Taliban came to power. Afghan women were dying at alarming rates during childbirth, and Wardak defied conservative authorities by providing medical care while refusing to veil her face. She was among the first cadre of women elected to parliament after the Taliban fell, and in 2010 she returned into being a full-time doctor to treat casualties from the insurgency against foreign forces. She wanted the bloodshed to end and saw the Taliban as the best hope for evicting the U.S. military. She also believed she could have a moderating influence on the Taliban in her community, many of whom she had known since they were boys. The past year had dashed her hopes. The Taliban have reimposed decrees that forbid women from traveling without a male relative, going to parks on the same day as men or showing their faces in public. "This is not Islamic," Wardak explains. "All my good opinions of them have changed. The world is going forward. We are going back." We follow Wardick to the district hospital, where she sometimes works, a Spartan facility dependent on foreign donors. Afghanistan's backcountry has been hit especially hard by lost aid, U.S. sanctions and asset freezes, along with low harvest and a harsh winter. In the malnutrition ward, Aisha hovers over her withered infant daughter, Reshma, who's being fed through an IV drip. At 8 months old, Reshma weighs less than 6 pounds. Hospital director Abdul Hakim sees 50 to 100 malnutrition cases a month and expects more. When the Taliban returned, many trained medical workers fled. Now we don't have enough doctors and supplies to treat people, Hakim says. Strikingly, the trauma ward is nearly empty. During the war, corpses of government forces and Taliban militants piled up like stacks of wood in the lobby, Wardick recalls. Today, the lone patient is a trucker getting his cheek stitched after a traffic accident to avoid a bomb crater on the road. Some miles down the highway, a rangy 50-year-old who goes by the nom de guerre Khan boasts that he's the man responsible for most of the Highway 1 attacks in the Saidabad district. From 2006 to 2019, he says his roadside bicycle repair shop was the lookout post for a bomb replacement squad that terrorized U.S. and Afghan envoys. By his count, they struck more than 2,500 vehicles. 16 people were killed in that explosion, he says, pointing to a bald patch of pavement. No one was safe on this road, he said. Khan is now a security guard at the Ministry of Public Works in Kabul, an irony not lost on him. Like every Taliban fighter we meet, he says he waged jihad because foreigners were corrupting Afghans' traditional ways of life. With the war over, his animus against outsiders has softened into curiosity, and he invites us for dinner. Rumbling across a floodplain at dusk, we pass vehicle carcasses staked with tattered prayer flags, memorials to comrades killed by U.S. drone strikes. Wood smoke rises from the high adobe walls of Khan's fortress compound, and we sit down to a meal of okra stew and unleavened bread, prepared by a wife and daughter we never see. We joined by his former comrade, who goes by the name of Ilham, a sturdily built man in a camouflage jacket. The pair reminisce over tea, nostalgic for the charged sense of purpose they once shared. Before, we suffered, but we were happy, says Ilham, who now works in a provincial passport office. Now I'm bored and not sure what to do. I miss the war. Wardick province, jagged gray ridges level into washed-out plains as we enter Ghazni province. The last time I drove here was in an armored U.S. Army convoy, and our trip was cut short when an improvised explosive device killed two Afghan policemen up front. This time, Taliban fighters inspect our truck for weapons and wave us on with an apology for the hassle. A sandstorm engulfs the highway, and it's getting dark when we reach Kandahar, the birthplace of the Taliban. In the past year, security has improved, and no one steals a single Afghani, Gulali, a vendor churning ice cream in the main bazaar, tells us, referring to the currency. We welcome them back. Several stalls down, fabric seller Sabor Sabori counters that while law and order have improved, there's a trade-off. People no longer can speak their minds freely. Whether you are happy or sad, he says, you say you are happy. Near the city center, the gravesite of Abdul Razik, a fearsome U.S.-backed police commander and Taliban nemesis, has been walled off, his once ubiquitous image stripped from billboards and car windows. At the height of his power, he ran Kandahar as his personal fiefdom, lining his pockets with customs revenue while police shook down merchants to supplement meager salaries and henchmen allegedly carried out torture and disappearances. Human rights groups have amassed credible evidence that the Taliban committed revenge killings against former government forces with some of the most blatant cases in Spin Baldock, the ancestral home of Razik. A four-mile line of empty, colorfully painted jingle trucks, so-called for the chimes that embellish the flatbed vehicles, waits to cross from Spin Baldock back into Pakistan. The crippled Afghan economy relies on imports. Nearly 28,000 pounds of commercial cargo pass through this border every day, along with UN aid convoys destined for far-flung provinces. The Taliban takeover sparked a human exodus for Pakistan and Iran, among them technocrats, doctors, engineers, and other professionals essential to running a functional state. To stem the brain drain and the flight of staff who worked at foreign missions and businesses, the Taliban decreed in February that Afghans without travel documents couldn't leave without special permission. Less than a mile beyond Kandahar's city limits, opium poppy fields flare up along the highway. Snow white, pale purple, and lipstick red, the flowers are loudly enticing everywhere. Growing opium poppies was banned for the last 2 years of the first Taliban government. The Taliban later taxed the sale of opium and heroin in regions they controlled during the U.S. occupation. According to the U.N. Office on Drugs and Crime, Afghanistan was the top producer of opium last year, yielding 7,500 tons worth as much as $2.7 billion, about 10% of the country's gross domestic product. Desperate to ease the economic crisis, the Taliban had a choice this year: crack down and deny rural poor their most lucrative crop or turn a blind eye. I wade into a field and inhaled the sickly sweet scent of poppy latex drying in the sun. Ali Jan, 36, scores bulbs with a purpose-made tool, as he has done since he was a teenager. He earns about $5 a day. If there were other work, we would have the opium business. We would leave the opium business, he says. Under the last government, John says he had to pay kickbacks to local authorities. So far, the Taliban aren't interfering, but there's a rumor they will reimpose a ban after harvest, allowing them to collect taxes now and curry favor later with Western countries seeking to stem the flow of heroin. Despite $8.62 billion in U.S. counter-narcotic spending, opium poppy cultivation surged during the war. Poppy fields multiply down a dirt track to Sangasar. The farming hamlet is unremarkable, except it was here that Mullah Muhammad Omar, a one-eyed veteran of the 1980s Mujahideen struggle to end the Soviet occupation, formed the Taliban in the 1990s. Warring commanders were killing and thieving during the civil war that broke out after the Soviet pullout, and Omar built a following of fundamentalist religious students known as Talibs, who captured all but a few pockets of the country in 1996. Omar fled to Pakistan after the U.S. invaded Afghanistan 5 years later and died of illness in 2013. His former village home was bombed, but the mosque where he was the imam has been rebuilt. An old comrade, Abdul Majid, tells me that Omar had the belief that whether he was dead or alive, the Islamic Emirate would one day prevail. He would say of the Americans, "You are the most powerful country in the world, and after 20 years, you will be the weakest." In Lashkar Gah, the capital of Helmand province, we link up with a Talib named Rozi Bilal, whom I'd met earlier at a sporting event in Kabul. He'd kept in touch, sending family pictures and updates, adamant that we meet again on my next trip. Given his cheerful demeanor and taste for social media, I assumed he was somewhat progressive. I was wrong. On a rutted road along the Helmand River, Bilal, 28, tells us he originally signed up to be a suicide bomber because he was outraged by U.S. airstrikes and raids on his community. Taliban officers thought him too smart to sacrifice and tasked him with training bombers instead. For 12 years, he led a double life as a militant and part-time university student. Co-education did little to temper his conservative values. Now a teacher, he insists women be separated. "Women are a distraction," he says, adding he had once a stubborn female student removed from his classroom for trying to study with men. The twinkling lights of Herat snap us back to life after a tedious drive through hard, barren country. Afghanistan's third largest city, with more than a 500,000 residents, is an ancient trade center that shares cultural ties with Iran, just 75 miles west. The old city's 15th-century citadel was restored in the 2000s, and the city retains a veneer of prosperity. But in the districts north of Herat, poverty is stark. There are widespread reports of parents selling daughters into early marriage to afford food for their families, and the sale of kidneys for transplants is on the rise. In Daswari, a highland village near the Turkmenistan border, residents have relied on U.S. aid and U.N. food deliveries since drought cut wheat output rather by more than half and decimated sheep. One in three children is malnourished here, community leader Arud Naidar. The Taliban government does nothing for us, he said. In one room, mud brick home, Ma Bibi weaves carpets 7 days a week to support her five children, earning $25 a month for her work. Now, her 10-year-old daughter Sharifa now toils alongside her. I wanted to be a teacher, but it is no longer possible, the girl says with resignation. In Baghzi province, one of the country's poorest, makeshift camps of displaced people straddle the highway waiting for aid deliveries that no longer come. The pavement crumbles into patches of dirt until it disappears. At a remote checkpoint in Dara Yibum, a Taliban guard looks bemused when I tell him we're driving to Mamamana in Farib province, the next major city 145 miles northeast. We start up a steep mountain track, and a boy runs up to us and warns us it's too dangerous, redirecting us into a riverbed. I check my smartphone map, which confirms we're still on National Highway 1. The riverbed is the road. So begins a punishing ride down a boulder-strewn canyon. Several times I get out and move rocks to continue. We grind on for the rest of the day, averaging 2 miles an hour, not another vehicle in sight. It's dark when we reach Bala Mugab, a dead-end town of fire-scorched ruins. We stop at a filthy tea house and eat tough kebabs in silence. A shopkeeper lets us crash on his floor, but we hardly rest. The route to Mamana is off-road, and we must follow a pre-dawn taxi to avoid getting lost. Soon we're slashing through hill clefts and edging along deep ravines, one rock slide away from tumbling into the abyss. There's no choice but to keep chasing the taxi's taillights and white-knuckle our way through a gauntlet of climbs and drops. When the pavement finally reappears 5 hours later, we reemerge as if from a fever dream. The ring road is a myth, I say aloud, wondering how many people could have driven the entire circuit. For all the claims of mapmakers and military planners, Afghanistan's celebrated highway is another overhyped nation-building project left incomplete. The smooth, sleepy drive into Shabrigajan, the capital of Jizan province, is a welcome relief, but the sun-blasted desert that surrounds the highway is haunted by a brutal past. We pass the turn to Dasht-e-Lilai, where in late 2001, as many as 2,000 Taliban fighters captured by Uzbek warlord Abdul Rashid Dostum suffocated in shipping containers and were dumped into mass graves. Dostum became first vice president and marshal of Afghan armed forces while reigning over Jizan with absolute forces for the past two decades, living lavishly in palatial homes in Afghanistan and abroad. An energetic Taliban information officer named Halil Bakai informs us that we drove past a recently discovered mass grave. Scattered bones have been spotted along the highway, and a man came forward claiming to have seen Dostum's fighters bulldozing bodies in 2001. Desert winds had licked the concealing sands away. Balkai cancels an appointment to show us the site. He drops to his knees and starts digging with his hands, unearthing jawbones, femurs, shreds of clothing. He moves to the next pile and the next and vows there will be justice under the new regime. At the bombed-out provincial court building, people are arguing their cases before turbaned clerics. Many disputes involve land. Ahmad Javed, 39, a clean-shaven IT professional in a leather jacket, alleges that Dostum's cronies seized his land. Dostum's people could do anything under the last government, he says. They beat me up and broke my left hand. I feel very happy the Emirate is here. My uphold Allah's law, or rather they uphold Allah's law, and not the strong men. Under the first Taliban government, justice was summary and brutal. Public hangings for murder and rape, amputations for theft. Mufti Saeed, Jaswan's chief justice affirms that the death penalty and dismemberments would again be enforced, though he had not done so yet. I notice a leather paddle on his desk and ask if he's ever used it. Only once, he smirks, recalling the man who ignored warnings to stop cursing in his office. That day, the Taliban announced a ban on opium from its cultivation to its use and sale. With government assets frozen and scant diplomatic recognition, the Taliban seemed to be trying to gain favor with the international community. Malawi Gul Mohamed Salim, deputy governor of Jaswan, concedes that there were problems during the last Taliban regime. A delegate at Taliban peace talks with the U.S. that were held in Doha, Qatar, he says the movement's leaders have traveled widely since the 1990s and want to engage with the world, not seal off the country as before. U.S. geologists estimate Afghanistan has $1 trillion worth of untapped minerals, enough to lift millions out of poverty if foreigners invested in infrastructure. The final stage of our journey is the 1.6-mile Salang Tunnel at an altitude of 11,000 feet, carving through the Hindu Kush, the mountains that divide the north from Kabul. A daring feat of Soviet engineering designed to handle 1,000 vehicles a day when it opened in 1964, the passage has degenerated into a muddy, potholed, smog-choked shaft through which as many as 9,000 vehicles drive each day. An untimely breakdown could snarl domestic trade, spike gas prices, and mean death for those trapped inside. The mouth of the tunnel is belching smoke as we enter. Visibility drops to zero. What seems like an eternity later, we emerge from the black lung and pull over to suck down fresh air before a winding descent to Kabul. There's one more detour to make to the Pashur Valley, the famous, or fabled rather, bastion of resistance that the Soviet army and first Taliban government never managed to tame. Pashur again held out when every other province fell in rapid succession in summer 2021, but Taliban fighters finally punctured its myth of impenetrability. The road into the valley knifes along sheer rock walls and rushing Emerald River. Billboards that once featured the late Commander Ahmad Shah Massoud and other ethnic Tajik heroes, have their faces scratched out. The mood is somber in this holdout of anti-Taliban sentiment. Maybe 5 out of every 100 families are left, only people who couldn't afford to leave, says Habulullah, a bakery owner in Unaba village. Every other shop is shuttered. Darkness, he says, is everywhere. What's left of the Panjshiri resistance has retreated up the mountains. Grainy videos on social media and funerals for slain Taliban indicate they're still fighting. But for now, resistance is mostly symbolic. When we reach Kabul, a massive new Taliban flag billows over Wazir Akbar Khan Hill, a park in the city center, a gathering there, bolstering the feel of a family reunion minus any women. Fighters from across the country laugh and take pictures, savoring their moment at the top after years in obscurity. And that, my friends, brings us to the end of today's episode of Armchair Traveler. Hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be with us next time. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and I remind you the content of our program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. The website, again, is ncreadingservice.org. Now, if you have any comments or questions, you may call 919-832-5138. That number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.